This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
It doesn't really matter whether you like rustic log cabins or whether you like Victorian-era houses or if you like mid-century modern homes or if you like homes that are made out of metal. Well, you get that choice in the Logs to Lustrons tour that's coming up here on May 4th and the evening before on May 3rd. There's going to be an illustrated talk. It's all going to happen at the Indiana Dunes National Park. And with me to talk about it is Todd Zeiger. He's the Northern Indiana Director of Indiana Landmarks, which sponsors this opportunity to see 13 Indiana Dunes landmarks this year. And Todd, you have some interesting things to tell us that so many people have wanted to sign up for this that you don't have any tickets left, I understand.
Really exciting for us and unfortunate for your listeners, but the Logs to Lustrons tour this year, almost 600 visitors for this tour, and we have successfully sold that out, which is outstanding, and it shows why we're particularly interested. It just shows how much interest folks have in exploring the new Indiana Dunes National Park, and not only the environmental side, which is, of course, everyone is aware of, but this cultural resource that's over there. A lot of folks are kind of unaware and really haven't explored this really 150 years worth of architecture within just a few minute drive in this national park. And that's fairly unusual in our national parks.
Now, we mentioned at the start of the conversation about the fact that there are going to be a couple events. The first one is actually going to be in the evening on May 3rd, and it's the illustrated talk, which is entitled Logs, Glass, and Metal is a History, a Century of Architectural Legacy, and a lot of discussion about history to sure to come out of this, I understand.
Absolutely. It's an opportunity just to present this other aspect of the Indiana Dunes National Park, and we take folks through it from the logs and really pre-European settlement all the way through the glass side, which we have the lecture at the Portage Park Pavilion there right on the lake, which is a ultra modern wonderful building for this, so we really can just take this walk through time through the lecture of almost 150 over a year's worth of architecture. It's pretty fascinating.
Now, when you talk about all these various architectural landmarks that are still up there, I know people think in particular about the Century of Progress homes, and we are going to get into, before we finish up today, talking about that, because they are coming back for an opportunity to see those if you haven't done so already. But these other landmarks too, you forget about the fact that there are two Swedish landmarks in the area. There's also a World War I era barn that's been restored and repurposed on the area as well, too. Just a lot of things to see that people probably don't have any idea that's up there at the National Park, Matt.
Absolutely, and it's great. Folks go up and they explore the dunes, and they go to the lake, and they take advantage of the wonderful park assets of walking through the woods. And scattered out through these acres of ground there at the park are these other assets, and we've been really great to work with the park in repurposing these houses and these other buildings for new uses. And one thing that we point out that a lot of folks don't think about, but the administrative headquarters there for the National Park is actually in an old Nike missile base. It's the administration headquarters for the old Nike missile base.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty fascinating part of American history that is right there at the dunes that we can talk about, the defense of Chicago through these part of the Nike missile base ring, and it's something that people just don't stop and think about. And so, through these lectures and the tours, we're just so happy to bring all these folks out and be able to explore that. And even outside the tours themselves, folks can stop at the visitor center and pick up information about these properties. And they can't get inside because they are being used privately, but they can take a look from the exterior and drive by them. And just to kind of bring this back, you mentioned the Century of Progress, and they really sit kind of right in the middle of this architectural history,
mm-hmm.
1930s, and we're trying to show how that fits as well.
Now, you also know, too, that there's a new addition that's going to be on the tour this year for folks that have been able to get their tickets and sign up for the tour. It's the Reed Dunes House. Tell us more about that. That's an addition, and maybe something that most people have not seen.
Yeah, mid-century architecture is really kind of a focus of historic preservation right now, and
mm-hmm.
The Reed Dunes House was the home of the Reed family, who were very much active along with others in helping get the national park itself established as the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. And their house was put on the National Register a few years ago, and kind of recognizing that history, the cultural history of the individuals that worked together to form the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, to really lobby Congress to get that done. And a lot of those homes have disappeared or aren't within the park, and the Reed Dunes House is still there. It was built in the mid-century in the 1950s, and we think it's an opportunity to talk about mid-century architecture, which is important. It's part of that architectural continuum, but also tell the story of the effort to start the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore and all the advocacy that went into protecting this wonderful asset there along the lake environmentally, and from that then the homes. And so it's never been opened before, and so we thought it was a good opportunity to show folks it's, you know, not a high-style building. It's a simple ranch from the 50s, but it's part of that story, and so we're excited to tell that.
Well, many of us have had our opportunity to say that was our very first home, was to have a home that kind. And I guess although I didn't have a home made out of metal like the Lestron homes we'll talk about, I've had prefab homes before where you had to basically drill holes in plywood because your walls were, your inside interior walls were plywood. So this is this case, I'm sure, with these Lestron homes. There are two of the prefab post-World War II enameled steel Lestron homes that are going to be up as part of the tour every year, and this is one of those opportunities. For folks that are not familiar with what the Lestron home is, please bring us up to date.
Lestron houses were part of that post-World War II effort to provide housing. There was a shortage of housing for returning GIs and others, and so there was just a variety of, you know, pre-manufactured housing that people were coming up with, and one of those efforts was the Lestron Corporation, who came up with a pretty ingenious system that brought 3,000 pieces to the site, and you could put your house together with basically three tools, a crescent wrench and a flathead screwdriver and a rubber mallet, along with a multi-page assembly manual, and you could build your house. And they were fascinating, all metal houses. Exterior walls, interior walls, roof, everything was all metal. And there are wonderful little properties. Of the 3,000 or so that were built, maybe half still survive today across the country. And there are two within the Indiana Dunes National Park. Of particular interest, there was very few three-bedroom versions built, and one of the ones that's on the tour is a three-bedroom that's owned by the park, and that's there's only, we figure, 250 to 300 of those three-bedroom ones built across the country, and there's one at the park there that we've been working to help preserve over the years, and they're fascinating little systems, and for those who finally, when they discover them, they're like, wow, I never knew this existed, so they're fun to show.
When your research that you did in getting ready for the tours, looking into these Lestron houses, and you mentioned there are only a handful, so to speak, I guess, of the three-bedroom homes, did the company that was putting these up decide that there was maybe a greater need for two bedrooms and only a limited amount of three bedrooms that were needed out there, and why they only put so many of the three bedrooms compared to the two bedrooms up?
I think that is really more a matter of timing. The Lestron Corporation was really only in business producing houses for a couple of years before a wide variety of factors came into play that took them out of business. If you've ever watched the show, the movie Tucker, and more time than we have to get into today here. But anyways, they went out of business within about 3 years, and the three-bedroom was an addition to the catalog later in their production. And so I would owe it more to a fact that they just didn't stay in business long enough to be able to manufacture a lot of them. But I think part of it, too, was there's probably more of a need for two bedrooms at the time. Yeah. So a little bit of both. But timing is everything, and the Lestron Corporation really fell victim to a variety of challenges in their latter years.
Well, do you think that maybe they were running into competition from the stick-built prefab homes? We're talking about ones like National Homes and some of the ones like it, the ones that are made out of wood as opposed to metal?
Yeah, when you introduce a concept to the market that's radically different and building your house out of metal, you're fighting a lot of different factors. You're fighting really uphill battle against contractors who are used to working with wood versus metal, your suppliers, and just people's general expectation of what a house is. So there's just a lot of factors that Lestron had to overcome, and uphill kind of working against the wind, use your analogy, in their efforts, and really hit a real wall politically and culturally and supplier and just a whole host of things that took Lestron down. And it's kind of fascinating why we like Lestron up there at the dunes is, if you think about it, really Lestron can trace its roots back to the Armco Ferrer house at the Century of Progress, which really was the first time this idea of building a all-metal house of porcelain clad was introduced, was at the fair at the Armco Ferrer. So at the National Park, within, you know, this tour, you can see the precursor to the Lestron and the Armco Ferrer. And I just drove by one this morning. If you're familiar with the old Amco stations from the 1950s, those had metal paddles on the exterior as well in that same time period. But all that can really be traced back to the Armco Faro from the 1933 World's Fair.
That's a fascinating lineage.
Now,
Todd, that you bring up the Century Progress, let's bring folks up to date here. We know that those houses, once again, it's not often that you get a chance to actually tour those homes. If there's an opportunity coming up anytime soon to actually get to see them?
Absolutely. Everybody can mark their calendars. Tickets for the annual Century Progress tour go on sale August 5th. Through IndianaLandmarks.org, so folks will want to check that webpage, IndianaLandmarks.org, for information about that, or sign up as a member, and you'll get kind of advance notice as well. Those tickets go on August 5th for the tour, which is the last weekend of September every year, and we run about 650 people through in that day as well. Last year, those tickets sold out in about 28 minutes, and so I would not encourage people to dawdle if you're interested in getting the ticket. It's a very popular tour that is just focused on those five Century of Progress houses, which will include the House of Tomorrow that we are seeking a sublessee for. So lots of things going on, and mark your calendar for that first Monday in August and get online to buy your tickets.
Well, now that we know that the tickets are all sold out for the Logs to Lustrans tour, and including the illustrated talk that's the night before, the talk is on May 3rd, and the tour itself is on May 4th there at the Indiana Dunes National Park. So we appreciate the heads up about knowing that you ought to get your tickets now if you want to check out the houses, and certainly with the Century of Progress homes coming up. Todd Zeiger is the Northern Indiana Director for Indiana Landmarks, and Todd, thank you for joining us. We appreciate the chance to talk with you and get some great comments, some history lessons, too, about these wonderful homes that are all part of the Indiana Dunes National Park.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate your interest and your listeners, and we look forward to seeing everybody at our tours. Thank you so much.
And Todd Zeiger, too, by the way, says that Indiana Landmarks is making a waiting list, so if there are any tickets that happen to come available for whatever reason for the May 3rd and the May 4th Logs to Lustrans event, they will go to that list. Refugees and other immigrants face lots of obstacles when it comes to getting health care, and the language barrier is one of the biggest. Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez-Valdiva visits a clinic in rural Missouri that's trying to help Congolese refugees.
At a pediatric clinic in Kirksville, a young boy is waiting in an exam room to be vaccinated. A nurse explains the shots to his mother, and Lisette Chibanvunya translates. Chibanvunya is one of two Congolese interpreters the Northeast Health Council has hired to help the clinic care for refugees and immigrants from Central Africa. She first came to town to study at Truman State University in 2013.
When I came, I faced discrimination because they didn't have a lot of black people. But now they start accepting people because they finally understand that people kind of decided to make it home.
Since then, the town estimates at least 800 Congolese people have arrived in the area, many coming to work at pork processing plants. Among them is Chibanvunya's colleague Babette Nzuzi, who says she was a doctor in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Like many skilled immigrants and refugees, she couldn't continue her work in the U.S. without going through an extensive relicensing process. Instead, she ended up working at the nearby Smithfield plant.
So I was just patient, and I used to work at Smithfield Farmland. And then a friend told me about application for a translate, so I tried, and they hired me.
While the DRC's official language is French, there are more than 200 languages in the country.
Some people cannot speak French. They speak Lingala. But for us, it's easy because we can speak French, Lingala, Swahili, Kikongo.
Before Nzuzi and Chibanvunya started working for the Health Council, doctors and nurses had to rely on automated translation services like Google Translate. But that left gaps.
They speak a different dialect of French, and so you can't even tell the translator phone French sometimes because they don't even understand that.
Amanda Wilford is a nurse practitioner who runs the Health Council's clinic in Milan, 30 miles to the west. She says having someone like Nzuzi who can translate over the phone is a big help.
And so we just call her on a cell phone, and she just pops off and on the cell phone whenever we need to call her. She's a very busy lady.
Nzuzi and Chibanvunya both came to the U.S. through the State Department's visa lottery. But thousands more Congolese have come as refugees. Last year, the U.S. took in more than 9,000 refugees from the DRC, nearly half of the total admitted. That country's continuing political instability and ethnic conflicts have displaced millions of people. When refugees arrive in the U.S., resettlement agencies help with the language barrier.
They provide the fundamentals of helping them find housing, helping children find schools, helping the adults find employment.
Dr. Anilai Anamalai is a psychiatrist and internist at the Adult Refugee Clinic at the Yale School of Medicine. She says these support structures can be critical for refugees' health.
We talk a lot in medicine about the social determinants of health, and especially more so for refugees because they're coming with nothing. So I think that basic foundation needs to be there.
But in a small town like Kirksville, where the nearest resettlement agency is an hour and a half away, there's more pressure on groups like the Northeast Health Council. And the interpreters help negotiate cultural differences as well. Chibanvunya recalls helping a patient who needed a C-section but didn't want one because in the DRC, they can be a lot more dangerous.
That language problem couldn't make the person understand that this is the only way we can do. So I came in and then I helped the lady understanding, and finally they end up having the baby through C-section.
Nzuzi wants to do even more for the area's Congolese community. She's working on her English skills so she can begin the process of obtaining a medical license in the U.S. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I am the first female Saudi pilot, officially. To be a pilot, you have to have a high school certificate. Then you apply in academy or aviation college to get a license. There is many different licenses, private pilot license, and then commercial instrument, which allow you to work and get paid for what you're doing as a job. The processing, there is a theory section. You have to pass it before doing the practical training. That would take, the average is about 18 months to do everything. The first thing I had to do, that to get the permission from the government to do it, but they said, we cannot say no, but we cannot say yes as well, because we cannot guarantee a job for her, and we cannot give her a scholarship for sure, because she's a pilot, and we don't support this. They said to my dad, if you want, you pay everything for her, we're not getting involved. At that time, we don't have academy for pilot training in Saudi Arabia. Even if we do have, they would not let me in because I'm a female, because it's only for men. I had to go to Jordan to do my training because I couldn't do it in Saudi Arabia anyhow. In Jordan, they were so very, very supporting. I cannot forget how they were cooperated with me as a female from Saudi Arabia. From the first day I arrived to school, they used to have even female instructors. This is the first thing convinced me that I can do it, because they have a female instructors. When I applied first at the academy in Jordan, I didn't know that I was the first. The manager and the instructors in the school, they told me that you are the first because there's no other female pilot in Saudi Arabia registered in any other countries. Maybe they have a private pilot license, they do it for fun, but there is no female pilot have a commercial license. So you would be the first. I was okay, this is exciting, I want to do it. I have to say, I have to admit that I wanted the title so badly. I want to do it. I want to get the title to be the first. It's something different. But afterward, it just feels, oh my God, what trouble I put myself in. It's a huge responsibility. It's no way to give up at any point, because if I would give up at some point, no other female in Saudi Arabia would be a pilot ever. Especially when the media started the press saying that there is a female pilot in Saudi Arabia and she is the first and she broke all the walls. She's challenging her society and this. It's I don't want to be in trouble with my country, but I'm doing it for myself. I'm not asking for something in my country. At the first, I wanted to get a license, picture with my uniform, and give it to my dad, put it in his office, saying to people that my daughter know how to fly. This is the only thing at the beginning. And then when I started actually training, and I knew that I was the first female pilot, I said to my dad, Dad, I want this as my career. This is my job forever. I want to work as a commercial pilot. Would you let me do that? He's like, I was dreaming to see you a commercial pilot, but I don't want to put this load on you. But if you want to do it, I'm behind you. The journey started from then that I had to finish. I have to succeed. I have to approve to the country that I'm able to do what man can do.
I would say that it's hard to remember how many times I've been a good neighbor or have had the benefit of a good neighbor. If I go all the way back to my childhood, probably the most unusual but the most prominent thing for me is that there was a woman across the street on our block who had debilitating rheumatoid arthritis, and so she was bedfast. So my mom would go over and help clean house for her. We might have lunch with her. We just visit. And then other times when I've lived in Indianapolis and had neighbors that have just been friendly, or they notice something amiss at your house, or take a package in from the rain. There's so many little ways that we end up being good neighbors to each other. And, you know, I think we often don't think about how the little things build up to create that relationship that you want with people you live around. It's not a responsibility or an obligation to any individual neighbor. It's sort of a common responsibility for your environment. It's why you don't empty ashtrays into parking lots, because somebody else is going to be there. You know, it's not your space to trash. Dump them out in your house if that's how you feel about it. Keep them at home. So I think there are real basic obligations that are certainly important. But some people don't even feel the need to follow those obligations, right? Trashing people's yards, yelling rude things at people. So that's a person who's not respecting their obligations to the community, I think, right? And then you get into the diversity issue. I mean, to me, that strikes right to it. The issue of acceptance, recognizing that people are different, but they're not less because they're different. You know, even economically, just because someone doesn't make as much money as you are doesn't mean that they're not smarter than you are. You know, if you don't recognize that, then you really are missing a lot about people. You don't have to love everybody, but you certainly, I think, should be polite to people when you see them on the street. I mean, that's one of the issues that we've had here with townies yelling racial slurs at students who may not be white Anglo-Saxon. And to me, that's a violation of whatever basic obligation you have to your community.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject, one word, .valpo.edu. The Indiana General Assembly is literally down for this 2019 session to just a few days, and it may even end by the end of this week. But of course, first, the new two-year state budget has to be finished up and approved by both houses, either in separate sessions or in a conference committee, before it goes to the governor to be signed and then put into law. And unfortunately, as things stand right now, there is no additional state funding set aside for the Hoosier State Passenger Rail Service for the next two-year budget. The Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance has been working very hard lobbying with as many groups as they can to get the support put back into the budget. And let's check in with the president of the Passenger Rail Alliance, Steve Coxhead, to find out more, pardon me, and also, too, to talk about a very special event that I understand is, I guess, kind of a rally of sorts coming up on Wednesday night. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, first, bring us up to date, if you will, if there's anything new to talk about, unfortunately, on the status of state funding, and we're talking about funding in the NDOT budget that would go to help support the Hoosier State.
Right. Well, of course, by law, the budget has to be completed. I think this session of the General Assembly has to adjourn no later than April 29th, which is coming up on us. The budget passed both the House and the Senate without funding for the Hoosier State, although attempts in both the House and the Senate were made to reinsert it, which were voted down. The House and Senate passed different versions of the budget, so now it is in conference committee where things may be changed, added, or deleted. So we have a small chance that funding for the Hoosier State could, in fact, be inserted into the budget during this conference period and then included in the final budget voted up by the General Assembly. So we are getting right down to the wire here. In that regard, Amtrak has partnered with Indiana Passenger Alliance and been holding a an event, really a, more of a press conference, at the Amtrak Beach Grove Shops Wednesday afternoon at 2:30 local time, which is Eastern time, in an attempt to open a dialogue between Amtrak, the Passenger Alliance, the public, and news media on the importance of funding the Hoosier State for another budget cycle and possibly improving the service so the ridership will go up and we will come nearer to covering the operating costs. We expect representatives from the 500-plus employees at the Beach Grove Shops, which include, I think, five or six different skilled trade unions, along with representatives from Amtrak Midwest and officials from Beach Grove and possibly some other towns along the line. I understand the mayor from Crawfordsville may, in fact, attend. Mm-hmm. Different elected officials, concerned parties, and legislators will be invited to attend and speak at the event. The purpose, really, is to, once again, try to raise awareness on the part of the public and our state legislators of the importance of funding this transportation channel and improving it, as opposed to letting it go and sliding into the past.
If something happens, and unfortunately, unless some a miracle, I suppose, comes about, but you can have to believe in miracles, I suppose, in this respect, to be able to keep the state funding in for the Hoosier State this time around, what's likely to happen? Will Amtrak just kind of put the service on hold in the hopes that there'll be some funds found available sometime?
Well, yes, and we have been working closely with Amtrak, especially in the last few weeks. If the budget passes without funding for the Hoosier State, the service will be suspended as of July 1st. At that point, Indianapolis will be served only by Amtrak's Cardinal, which runs only 3 days a week at an inconvenient schedule and originates in New York City and so is prone to delays. Okay, at that point, the default assumption is we have no Hoosier State service for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, we have another budget cycle, and of course, if this happens, we and Amtrak and others will be definitely pushing to have the funding reinstated at that time. There are other ways, possibly, that funding could be found, none of which is very certain, okay. The state has a $33 billion budget. It's possible that some of our friends may find money in other places. We have 2 years to go in the current administration in Washington, 2 years to the next congressional elections. It's possible federal funds may be found that would be applied. Our understanding is that there are federal funds which, in theory, would be available for projects of this sort, but in order for NDOT to pursue that, they have to be directed by the governor and the commissioner to do so, which at the moment, my understanding is they have not been. Mm-hmm. So, yes, miracles are possible. There are other options, but the default and the expected condition is that the service would disappear for at least 2 years.
Tell us, if you will, how much money was originally planned to go into the budget if it had stayed in the budget to begin with, that would have served as the NDOT matching money for the Hoosier State?
Well, somewhat, the state portion, somewhat under $3 million per year. So we're talking in round numbers, say $6 million for the two-year budget cycle. Here again, the state budget is $33 billion. I know the governor's allocated something like $80 million to develop hiking and biking trails throughout the state. And while there's certainly nothing wrong with that, and they're certainly needed, you would have thought that $3 million, $6 million would have been an amount of money small enough that it could have been found someplace. So that's the money. Some other interesting numbers. Last year, the Hoosier State by itself carried over 27,000 passengers that collectively traveled over 4 million miles. If the Hoosier State had not been available, 59% of those passengers would have had to drive themselves, which means they would have added to traffic on I-65. 10% of those trips simply wouldn't have happened at all. So whatever the business those passengers were involved in would not have been taken place. Interestingly enough, a study released by the Rail Passengers Association, which is a national advocacy group, estimates that if all those passengers on the Hoosier State had been forced to drive, the state would have incurred roughly $3.1 million in additional road maintenance costs. You know, you can look at additional traffic and you can figure out what it costs to maintain things like I-65, and you can see what maintenance costs are incurred by adding additional traffic. So those, I think, are some interesting numbers here, you know, which aren't paid as much attention as I think they should.
Mm-hmm. How much lobbying did you and your colleagues with the Passenger Rail Alliance get to do here in the weeks, I guess, after the Amtrak announcement came out that they would have to suspend service on July 1st? Did you get much time to talk with enough people to get them to help you out here in the last few days of the session?
Well, we've been talking with people for several months now, and I would say we have definitely talked with a lot of people, enough people. Whether we convinced anyone is another matter. Mm-hmm. But we have definitely had a presence. Amtrak has definitely had a presence in the State House. We have communicated with the governor's office, with NDOT. We have communicated with a number of state senators and state reps, as has Amtrak. So this process has been ongoing. It started basically when the governor, several months ago, when the governor released his draft budget for this cycle, and we saw that the funding was not there, and has been ongoing. I might have mentioned motions to reintroduce it were introduced in both the Senate and House sessions. Unfortunately, they didn't pass. So we have been working. We have been contacting various news media, especially in central Indiana, which is where Indianapolis is, of course, to attempt to raise awareness and to encourage people to contact their representatives in the General Assembly and, you know, express their interest in the issue. So we have been working for a number of months now. Of course, you know, the pace has speeded up, you know, as we get down to the wire here with the General Assembly session coming to a close. Mm-hmm. Amtrak, by law, was required to give NDOT a 90-day notice of suspension of service, which, of course, they did when it looked like the funding was not going to be there. When we got to the 70-day mark, Amtrak sent a letter to NDOT and, of course, you know, released a press release to the effect that the service would, in fact, be suspended as of July 1st. So there has been a lot of activity. You know, I will say one thing, Chris. It's an issue that it is very hard to get massive public awareness on because people just aren't thinking about alternatives to driving these days. But we have been making a full court press on this.
Do you think that, at least you get the impression in getting set up, working with Amtrak and the other parties for this news conference in Indianapolis, or Beech Grove tomorrow, mm-hmm. that there's going to be enough central Indiana support or awareness to be sure to do a little more pressing on lawmakers to get them to help out?
Well, that is our hope. I mean, the future is uncertain, but yes. Our hope is that if we get enough grassroots pressure on central Indiana lawmakers, enough public awareness, you know, those people, for good or for bad, from the central part of the state, do carry an awful lot of influence, both within the Republican Party and the General Assembly as a whole. So, admittedly, we are making a fairly last-ditch effort to change the minds in that group of people.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for the update, and we will certainly keep an eye out on what comes out from tomorrow's big announcement and of getting more support at the last minute for NDOT to make sure that there is money in the budget for the next 2 years for the support of the Amtrak Hoosier State line. And we'll keep our, as we say, the miracles can happen, I suppose, and with any luck that you may have the help here that may come up here, it may come at the last moment, but I'm sure that's typically the way these things happen. It's certainly the way it happens.
happens on Capitol Hill. It's just that we hope that it didn't happen to the State House that way, to be sure. Steve, thanks very much for bringing us the update, and we'll hopefully have some good news to report here by the end of the week.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Steve Coxhead is president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. Small business owners in Northwest Indiana have a new advocate. His name is Philip McCandies, and he is the regional business officer of the Indianapolis-based Community Investment Fund of Indiana. He was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about the fund and about its role in helping small businesses, and local businesses in particular, grow and thrive.
We are a nonprofit. We are, you know, a CDFI, and we are literally just a micro lender. We're here to serve the community from the ground with the community and with the business owners that are working within the community.
Are they basically, I guess, a kind of a conduit between banks or other lending institutions and the businesses themselves?
Yeah, we want to be that partner with the banks and with the community to usher them to the banks, because a lot of the times small businesses do not realize what the requirements are for banks, because banks look for specific requirements from specific businesses, and some just go at it in the dark, and they just had a little. If they had a little guidance, we could help them get there.
When you talk about establishing small businesses and the small business community in general, they're really a kind of a mosaic, aren't they, of what business is really like here. They're making up all kinds of different sizes of businesses, I guess, different types of people that are business people. They're not your cut and dried ones, are they?
No, they're not. We want to lend to the mission of each individual business, and we are mission driven. So we want to support the mission of each individual business in that unique way. So there might be some businesses that there are a couple businesses that came to me needing. At first, they thought they needed capital, but they actually needed social capital.
Uh-huh.
They needed to be put into place with the right people. They needed to put in. They needed a different marketing tool. They needed to be put to somebody that actually could introduce them to a bigger outlet for their product. You know, so it always for us, it's always about getting the right type of capital to the client and to the entrepreneur in the community, which is not always financial. Which is what we like to provide, and we want to provide that. But some of them we do not want to overcapitalize and overfund. And a lot of the times that these good business owners in Northwest Indiana, a lot of times they just need a nudge in the right direction, a little encouragement. And some of them, two or three of them, were like, you know, let me stop for the loan right now. I see what you did. And they turned it, they made a couple of changes, and they didn't even need us. And I tried to get a loan to them.
Have you found, and this is probably the case all across the state for that matter too, that many of the small businesses that the Community Investment Fund of Indiana and your office that you work as a regional office here in Lake County in particular get to work with, are these folks that are people that they may be getting a business underway, maybe trying to help take over a business for a family member that maybe has passed on or just have turned over the business to somebody in the younger generation? And so that's why these are great people that are taking over business. They maybe know the business well, but they're not quite as skilled on the financial end of this, and this is why that they turn to people like you.
Yes, that's correct. A lot of the time when there is a business passed on, there is a somewhat of a financial taking from the person that is acquiring. That's just the business. And a lot of the time those people will have either worked for the business or they're just, it may have been, you know, a medical condition, or it just may have just been left in a will to them, and they want to just, you know, take it over for their parents and continue the legacy. For whatever reason it is, helping them get that education and get them the right technical assistance always comes back to not just our bottom line, but it also comes back to the bottom line of the community. We always want to be the CDFI for the city, so or the region or the state. We want our CDFI to be your CDFI. So if you need us and you come to us for resources about how to do your accounting, we want to be that resource for you. You know, we want to make sure we get you to the proper people in the area. So we're not just going to put one CPA over here because that might not fit how you do business. We will give you a host of CPAs that we've worked with in the area, and we will give you a list, and we would advise you to go talk to each individual one to help you with your business. And that, in turn, helps them run their business better, helps them create, you know, track their cash flow, and helps us create a proper loan package for them.
More information about the Community Investment Fund is found online at capitalizingindiana.org. This is Regionally Speaking. Well, from time to time, we'd like to check in with Indiana economist and writer and speaker Morton Marcus as he puts out his Eye on the Pie columns that are available out there. And Morton, thank you for joining us from Indianapolis to bring us an update on some of these interesting economic-related topics.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Chris.
Well, you start out with the fact the latest column, Eye on Pie, is, I guess you could say it is a rather verdant allegory.
Verdant allegory? Yeah. Oh, aren't we getting fancy?
This looks like an allegory because he starts out, the first sentence in the column says, "The new green is on the trees and the forest floor in front of me." Well, if that isn't something that you might run into at Gabus Arboretum, I don't know what you think otherwise. But it's a way to be able to put something that we enjoy this time of year, as it's springtime and soon to be the summer months, that we'll enjoy those dark forest floors when it's extra hot outside. But it's interesting how you tie it in together with how our average pay, our average salary is here in Indiana. Tell us what gave you the idea to come up with that on the jobs data.
Well, the jobs data are out there. My concern is that I felt it was necessary to explain the difference between what's called the average or the mean salary or wages that a person gets, and the median pay for a group of people, because one can be very different from the other. And this is something that I don't know whether it's covered in the sixth grade or the seventh grade or at all in our schools, but it's a big difference. For instance, in Indiana, this is for last year, 2018, the average or mean annual pay for a job was $45,300, and which ranked about 35th in the nation. Now, what that does is it reflects a lot of the high-paying jobs, whereas if you want the number, which will tell you half of the people in the state make more than this amount and half make less, then you really want what's called the median, which is that figure which is in the middle of this distribution.
Yeah.
And that's $35,700. Well, just think about that. That's a big difference between $35,700 and $45,300. There's, $9,000-some-odd in there, about $9,500 difference. But what are our kids in school being told? You know, or what do they find out when they go online? And so many places I see these listings that say the average salary is such and such. Well, which average is it? Which figure? Is it the mean or is it the median? That, to me, is the important question that people need to raise. But if I started off at the beginning saying, I'm going to take you back to the sixth grade and talk about the mean and the median, I'd have lost everybody in the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have no readers at all. So what I do is I create a character, Fay of the Forest, who comes and sits on the railing, and I've used her before. She's sort of a forest, I can't think of the word that I'm looking for, sprite.
Oh, right.
And It's a useful device to be able to present information in a way that's a little bit more engaging. So many people think that when you're talking about economic situations, you have to be dull, you have to be very, very serious. Well, you can be serious and you don't have to be dull.
One of the other columns, too, that you had out there as well, I mean, you were talking here about the importance about how your pay happens to be set, is that obviously whether we're in a particular business, it's obvious that they're tied internationally, like the steel makers or any other type of related business. We're all living with these international markets, and it's very important to have the involvement of foreign investment, I'm sure, in many cases that basically helps keep Hoosier businesses alive. That's one of the topics of one of your columns, too. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Right. I think it is very important. We have a lot of foreign companies that operate in the state of Indiana, whether you want to start with ourselves, Middle, mm-hmm. or you want to talk about Toyota or Honda? We have Japanese companies, we have British companies, we have companies from India, we have companies from China, and many people were shocked and surprised when the first bids that came in for the toll road lease came from a Australian Spanish consortium. We just have lots of involvement with the rest of the world, and that's basically very good for us because it's much better for us to have foreign companies investing here and creating jobs for Americans and bringing in new equipment, bringing in new techniques. Sometimes it's awfully easy to just do things the way your neighbors do things. You know, nobody wants to be really different. Well, that's true in business also. But if a foreign company comes in, very often they bring something different. Look what Aldi's has done in terms of its success in the grocery market. A lot of grocery companies in the United States are having troubles, but Aldi's is expanding because they're offering the consumer something that's a bit different from what they otherwise have had. And yes. I think that's very healthy for competition gives us a lot of jobs that otherwise were going away because of the failure of so many of our grocery stores to be able to stay open.
Now, you mentioned about the competition that's involved in that here, that gives the local guys a real run for their money. And sad to say, in some cases, although they may not have been prepared for the competition to begin with some supermarket chains like in central Indiana and with Marsh, which is a long-established chain that's gone out of business, and how it's been taken over by other companies and the like, but how they've managed to fall by the wayside, and yet companies like you say, like Aldi, have been able to thrive.
Right, and when the finally comes out, we get the information. We see that the Marsh had a very weak management system. I don't want to say necessarily weak managers, but in many cases, that was it. Also, they just were not attending to the business as they needed to, and that's how you lose out to your competitors very often. If the boss spends too much time on the golf course, it really isn't good for business.
One of the other Eye on the Pie columns that you put out here talks kind of get on the money theme about personal debt. And you said your mother had an aphorism that you had your fun, now you have to pay for it. It's paying the piper, you know. I guess that's
exactly.
But it's an interesting way to be able to phrase the problems that we all face in one mm-hmm. way or the other about debt.
Well, yes, the inability of Americans of the last generation or two to put off pleasures such as having your own house, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily a pleasure when you start thinking about how much time you're going to have to spend mowing the lawn this summer. But when Americans have a lot of difficulty in saying, no, I'll get it later, we are seeing perhaps a change in terms of this millennial generation. They don't seem to be buying as much. They seem to be renting more. They seem to be borrowing and sharing. The whole Uber phenomenon is just a different way of behaving. Whether that will last or not, of course, is an open question. But, Americans spend about $9.1 billion, with a B, billion dollars for costumes and candy and other necessities of Halloween. $9 billion for Halloween. And what is it that you have? Almost everything is consumed. It isn't used again. There's no investment there. It's all pure consumption. And think about the amount of money that we're spending for Netflix or Amazon or any of these other things, the streaming services on our TV. It's the entertainment bills of the American family have gone up dramatically. It used to be that if you went to the movies, once or twice in a month, that was big time. But now we're bringing these things directly to our homes and paying what amounts to a small amount compared to going to the movies today, but nonetheless still spending a good deal of money on entertainment. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get around what's been happening to America, and a large part of it comes from the fact that I believe we put money into the hands of children starting in the 1950s. Before the 1950s, we didn't have a weekly allowance for young people. Now it's a routine thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, young people who have no patience to wait, whose brains haven't developed the concept of savings and investment, they go out and they spend their money.
Well,
that to me is a very serious matter.
Well, Morgan, what a sobering thought as we get close to the end of Financial Literacy Month, to be sure. And you get the last word, as a matter of fact. Morgan Marcus is an Indiana-based economist and writer and speaker, and we always appreciate your comments when we talk about money matters. Thanks for being with us today.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.